Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ross Navatoff. I represent Ms. Howard in this case. There is no dispute in this case that the only issue for this court is the government's contribution account and how it plays with the speech and the debate clause. The first thing this court needs to understand, however, is that when the House terminated Ms. Howard from her position as senior advisor, she had been removed from her budget job. She had nothing to do with the budget at all. She was a senior advisor. She was in charge of modular furniture and so and so. And then the House assigned her this job. Now the first question is, what was her assignment? No one knows, because in Ms. Howard's First Amendment complaint, she alleged she was asked to set up the government contributions account, whatever that means. Then in the affidavit that the House provided pursuant to Fields, the House says she was asked to analyze and reconcile the account. So the first question is, how can the speech and debate clause be implicated when we don't even know what the assignment was? Especially at this stage of this proceeding, we have had no discovery. Ms. Howard has had no procedural protections whatsoever. And even under Fields, the problem here is that Ms. Howard can prove her case without implicating the speech and debate clause. She could take the stand and testify that she was asked to set up this account, she was denied access to the resources to do the account, she was asked to set it up with a Caucasian white female who was not fired. She was denied the resources until very late, and even then she was completely denied one share drive, so she couldn't do it, so she was not insubordinate. At this stage, right now, we can establish that she was not insubordinate. That is sufficient to prove pretext. The speech and debate clause is not even implicated in this case, because as the House concedes, she was fired for not doing anything with respect to the government contributions account. So how in the heck can it be implicated when it's not even involved?
I ask him, what is your position as to what she was supposed to do, what setting up an account means?
My position is that is a ministerial act.
I know the word that describes it, but what is the actual event? I mean, is this data entry? Is this something else?
I believe it was downloading already obtained data that she did not obtain.
So there's no analysis of the data. It's just putting the data into the computer program?
Yes, that is it. That is it. That is setting up the account. She was supposed to download the data, but she was never given the resources to do so, and then they axed her. And on page 46 of the House's brief, I think there is a very revealing paragraph as they try to pound this round peg into a square hole. They say anything related to the government's contribution account, whether done by the CAO or done by Ms. Howard, necessarily constitutes reconciliation and analysis of the account. That can't be true. That's absurd. That means if she was asked to convert the account from Microsoft Excel to a PDF file, that's reconciliation and analysis of the account. They speak in generalities because they're trying to get the speech and debate clause involved in this case, and they're wrong, and Judge Kennedy was wrong. And they're also wrong because Ms. Howard's allegations in her complaint should have been construed as truthful in the light most favorable to her. That has always been the standard. Now, the House says, wait a minute, that's not true when it comes to 12B1 cases, subject matter jurisdiction cases. Well, it is still true. Yes, you can consider extrinsic pleadings.
Can I ask a question? Why is this a 12B1 case at all?
It's a subject matter. I mean, the court does not have subject matter.
Why is that? I thought both sides agree that the jurisdictional prong of the field plurality doesn't apply at all. So this is, we're not in the jurisdictional realm. We're in the evidentiary privilege realm. Is that wrong?
I don't think that's wrong.
Then why didn't you tell me that?
I just did.
I got it, but I mean, I'm not trying to trip you up. I'm asking him, I'm missing something here. So there's two prongs to the, if we take field purposes of this discussion, the plurality. There's the absolute immunity, which the court describes as jurisdictional, Judge Randolph describes as jurisdictional, and then there's the evidentiary privilege, debate about how far it goes, testimonial, et cetera, but still it's a privilege. Why do we address the privilege under 12b-1?
The House's motion to dismiss was premised on 12b-1, and Judge Kennedy's ruling was premised on 12b-1.
Why aren't you telling me that that's all wrong? That was right until we reached the stage where everybody agrees this is no longer a jurisdictional case, and now the case is 12b-6.
We have said from day one that this case should have been allowed to go forward subject to the evidentiary privilege.
I'm just, from your point of view, this is really not a jurisdictional case anymore because everybody agrees that the jurisdictional prong has been passed over, has been successfully passed over. Is that right?
I think that's right, at least from our perspective. I'm not sure. I can't speak for the House.
Well, I'm going to ask the House, don't worry. I can see he's making notes already.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
But this issue that the House raises, that the fact should not be viewed in the light most favorable to Ms. Howard, and they cite Jerome Stevens for this distinction between a facial and a factual attack. Well, that's true. If we assume, for purposes of this argument, that there is a 12b-1 part here, the problem is, even when you look at outside pleadings in 12b-1, extrinsic material, you still have to view the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And in the Jerome Stevens case that the House says was a facial attack, they're just flat wrong, because in the House Stevens case, there was an economic loss report attached to the motion to dismiss. There was extrinsic material. That was a factual attack, and this court's explicitly held that the facts still must be viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. So at the end of the day, if you view the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, the House's answer corroborates those facts, admits those facts, then they come forward with an affidavit pursuant to Fields, which contradicts their own answer. And Judge Kennedy did not reconcile these facts. He did not provide Ms. Howard any procedural protections whatsoever. He just said, all the conversations between Ms. Howard and her supervisors are off limits because of the speech and debate clause. And I do not understand that.
So in Fields, Judge Randolph's opinion said, once the affidavit's filed, the district court must then determine whether the asserted activity is in fact protected by the speech or debate clause. If it is, the action most likely must be dismissed. So where do you, they did the affidavit here.
And the House.
And it does describe on its face speech or debate clause activity. So why shouldn't the case be dismissed?
Because the court's wrong. It's not speech and debate activity. The specific task that Ms. Howard was assigned with to set up the account is not integral to any legislative process to set up the government contributions account. Moreover, she can prove pretext without delving into or implicating the speech and debate clause whatsoever.
Okay,
she
so
can prove.
You disagree on both sides of it. First, that it doesn't get into the speech or debate activity, and second, the part where the opinion then goes on to say we need not consider certain fact patterns that weren't present in Fields. You're arguing both sides of that, I guess.
I think he's completely wrong, and I would add a third prong to it. In Fields, they said you can't quarrel with the affidavit.
Right.
We're not quarreling with the affidavit. Their affidavit contradicts their own answer.
But what's going to happen if this went forward? Wouldn't they have to put on evidence trying to support the affidavit?
Under Rostenkowski, if they want to put on speech and debate evidence, they can. That is not a reason to dismiss a case just because they might have to put on speech and debate. That's clearly what United States versus Rostenkowski.
No, if they have to put on speech and debate, that is a ground, isn't it? It's only if it's voluntary.
Yes, excuse me, that's right. But it's not speech and debate. The issue here, it's a very simple case in terms of whether Ms. Howard was terminated properly. It's very simple. It comes down to this. Ms. Howard will testify. She was denied access to certain computer hard drives and access to set up the account. That does not implicate the speech and debate clause. It doesn't even implicate the government contributions account. It would be no different.
But their answer does. Their explanation, I mean, does.
Well, that's for the fact finder to decide.
No, but the problem is it's speech or debate. They're going to have to present speech or debate protected activity in order to present their view of what happened as compared to your view of what happened, and that's, a problem. Can I ask a broader question?
Sure.
Kind of pragmatic question, which is why, when you're making the choice, do you go to court rather than the Office of Compliance process? In other words, what are the advantages of doing the court process rather than the Office of Compliance process?
The advantage is you're in court in front of a judge. I mean, and you're allowed either option.
In terms of remedies and things like that, is it all potentially the same?
I really not sure, because I've never utilized the compliance side. I've always gone to court.
Well, it just seems that a couple things. One is, it seems to me, and get your comment on this, which is it's really important for us to establish a clear line here, because we are inducing future plaintiffs to come to court, perhaps mistakenly, and thereby forfeit rights they would have had under the Office of Compliance process, where there is no speech or debate clause issue. Can you comment on that? I mean, seems like bright lines are particularly important in this context, because future plaintiffs, if we have a fuzzy line, are going to say, oh, we'll go to court, and then they might not be able to pursue their case, and it's too late then, right, because you can only get
one shot.
One shot at making that choice, and once you make the choice, you've lost your rights under the Office of Compliance process.
The Congressional Accountability Act clearly allows you to go to court, and it's a choice, and you live and die with your choices. And in terms of a bright line,
what I'm worried about is inducing people to make the choice to come to court, and then them 3 years later, after thousands of dollars in legal fees or legal time, not getting anywhere. That worries me. It's just an overarching principle I'm bringing to bear for myself on this case, which is I want the rules of the road to be very clear so that people are making informed choices.
I mean, I'm not sure you can create a bright line there, because Congress has allowed either option, so it is what it is.
I'm just turning, in terms of the speech or debate clause, to the extent we can get more clarity, it seems to me that's a value. That doesn't tell you where the line's drawn.
No.
I would just like it to be relatively
But I think
clear.
It's very arduous to draw a bright line when it comes to the speech and debate clause, as the cases have shown. I think that's the problem.
Is a problem. I agree. So you know where I'm coming from. I'm trying to find something that can be relatively clear going forward. I'm not sure we're going to be able to find that, but that's a goal.
But I think in this case, the speech and debate clause, you know, based upon Brewster's holding that not just because it's related to legislative functions doesn't mean the speech and debate clause is implicated. At best, this one-time assignment might be related to the speech and debate clause only because the government contributions account, at some point, some of those numbers might go into an appropriations bill. I mean, we're talking about like link after link after link until you finally get there. There might be a nexus. I'm not even conceding it is related to a legislative function. But I'm saying in this case, under Fields, Judge Randolph's plurality opinion clearly said that if you can't prove pretext without implicating the speech and debate clause, you're out. And we believe that we can establish pretext now without implicating the speech and debate clause, because of the House's inconsistencies and because of Ms. Howard's testimony. And at this stage, prior to any discovery occurring whatsoever, prior to any procedural protections being provided Ms. Howard, we should be allowed to do that. And I do not believe the House has to present speech and debate clause to refute Ms. Howard's claim here. The only issue is whether or not she was insubordinate, i.e., did they prevent her from doing her job? That has nothing to do with the government contributions account. It has to do with whether they gave her the resources, the hard drives. It has nothing to do with the substantive numbers, the analysis, or anything related to that account. It would be no different if she were assigned to convert the government contributions account from Microsoft Excel to PDF, and they didn't give her a computer to do it. The House would say, wait a minute, it's speech and debate. And I would say, no, it's not, because it has nothing to do with the account. It has to do with whether or not she was provided what she needed to do the job. In other words, she wasn't insubordinate.
Can I ask you, I'm not sure how you're planning on dividing your time with respect to your demotion issue. You are not planning to defend that position?
I am planning to defend that position in the next 4 minutes and 40 seconds. It's interrelated with the termination issue because the same occurrence is there, which is different reasons. Again, when she was demoted to senior advisor, they told her the budget directorship was being abolished. Now all of a sudden in the affidavit we have performance-related issues, we have other things. She was never told those things. There is no paper that says those things. In fact, the only paper so proves she was doing an exemplary job as the head of the finance department, the budget department. Inconsistent explanations at this stage by themselves can establish pretext. Remember, we've had no discovery. We don't know what else is out there. That's what Judge Candy ruled, and he was correct in that because he saw the inconsistent explanations, and that really does go to the fact finder, and it doesn't implicate the speech and debate, and we're not going to bring up anything related to her work with House committees or anything like that. We don't have to. We're going to prove her demotion was illegal and in violation of Title VII because her career was exemplary, as illustrated by her appraisals, and she was specifically told the budget directorship was abolished when they removed her from that position.
Their explanation will be?
Performance.
Performance, and that will entail describing her performance on certain legislative matters, right?
Well, if they want to.
Well, I don't see that. That's their stated reason. And
that is their stated reason, but there's no support for that. See, and this goes to the issue of you.
But I'm not sure if just going to the field's plurality, I'm not sure. Once it's stated, I thought that was it.
But it has to be speech and debate. In fact, Judge Kennedy specifically said that she's allowed to go forward on her demotion claim, but she can't impinge upon any speech and debate material. And that's exactly what should happen with the termination and retaliation counts. You go for it. Should be the evidentiary privilege in this case.
What is her position with respect to the claim that she communicated information that reflected her own budgetary preferences rather than the views of the CAO?
Her position is that has nothing to do with her demotion, and it will not. We will not present it at all.
Well, but they're gonna argue that. Is your position that this didn't happen at all, that she did not communicate her preferences, or that they are irrelevant, or do we just not know that yet?
They are irrelevant, and we don't have discovery. But
and we also don't have a statement from their client yet either.
Right. But it's not relevant at this stage of the proceeding. Remember, we're at the motion to dismiss stage. We haven't had discovery, but it's not relevant because whatever they say is contradicted by the paper, and that is the pretext. You can't give different explanations and then say it's speech and debate, so it doesn't matter. I mean, that's
would you agree that if you ask for information and they say this has to do with the speech and debate clause, that they don't have to produce it? When you say you're entitled to discovery, what does that mean in this context?
It means we ask for discovery, and if there's a challenge with respect to the speech and debate clause on the documents, that the magistrate or the district court has to rule on as we go, just like in a criminal case. It's no different in a criminal case. It's no different than Brewster, where, you know, the criminal case was allowed to go forward. You just couldn't introduce evidence of the actual vote or bill.
So if they reassert what's in the affidavit, which you say creates the appearance of pretext because it's different. It's not inconsistent, it's different. They could reassert it, then the case would be over, right?
No.
Why?
Because it's not speech and debate.
No, on the demotion?
On the demotion, if...
If their second reason, which you're saying creates an appearance of pretext, if they say that was really the reason, we didn't say it initially, that's true, that's not, she's right, we didn't say that initially. but what we put in the affidavit is accurate, and we're not going to go into it any further than that. Doesn't that end it under Fields?
I don't think so.
Why?
Because there's another inconsistent explanation out there. My time is up. May I answer?
Oh, wait, finish. I'm not understanding. I mean, the whole framework is complex and perplexing, but I'm not entirely sure what you're meaning to say in light of Fields. You claim they stated one thing when she was demoted. Their affidavit says additional things.
That's
correct. Doesn't purport to refute what she says. It just cites additional things that go to performance, which clearly puts them in the speech and debate category.
For one of them.
The demotion. I'm not talking
right,
talking about the termination.
Right.
For the demotion.
For the demotion. But one of the reasons, it was only, I think in their affidavit they had three reasons for the demotion, and one was precisely linked to speech and debate,
right.
Conversations with, I think, the House committees.
Right.
Okay, and Judge Kennedy said that we're not allowed to go into that,
right.
And we don't intend to go into that, and we don't intend to present any evidence contradicting that. But the other two reasons were not speech and debate. And if they want to show that, they can, on their own, voluntarily say, this is why we did it. And then we would present evidence showing inconsistencies or other reasons, and then that would be submitted to the fact finder.
I'm still not sure I understand.
Well, I must say,
can't they simply assert? It's in our affidavit. We're not going any further. That's what Phil said.
That's what they're trying to do now.
No, I mean, are you saying that's not what Phil says?
I don't think Field says that. I think the only thing, I'm over my time, but I'll keep going. I think what Fields is very confused.
Just so you know, this isn't the Supreme Court. We let you keep going as long as the judge asks you questions.
Okay, thanks. I mean, Fields is very confusing. It's four opinions. You really don't want to ask my opinion about it, but it's totally perplexing. But here's the thing about Fields. Fields, at least for purposes of this case, Fields said a claim would be dismissed if the plaintiff can't prove pretext without implicating the speech and debate clause. That's the only issue here. And I say we can prove pretext without implicating the speech and debate clause, so we should be able to proceed down this path where the speech and debate clause will be protected by the magistrate judge or the district court judge at a later date. And you know what? If we can't prove or we implicate the speech and debate clause later in a motion for summary judgment, then we're out.
You just said something about what your strategy is going to be. I want to be sure I understood what you said. So if whoever is their witness gets on the stand and said she was fired in part because she communicated her own budgetary preferences and views rather than the views of the CAO, you will stipulate that that is correct. She did do that?
If the House presents that.
I don't mean in the sense of the House have to saying what they are. The House just says she communicated her own views. She did not communicate the views of the House, of the CAO. This is, a major sin with respect to an employee. And that's the reason that she was fired. You will agree that she did, you won't agree that was the reason she was fired, but you will agree that she communicated her own views rather than the views of the CAO. Is that right?
Yeah, because we can't contest that. Okay. And for those reasons, we respectfully request that you affirm Judge Kennedy with respect to the demotion count and reverse him with respect to the termination and retaliation counts. At this point, it was premature to dismiss those two counts. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. Gary Kircher on behalf of the Chief Administrative Officer of the House. Mary Beth Walker is with me at the council table. Before I get into the details, let me try to address a couple of the very large issues that I think I heard presented in the opening round of questioning. Judge Kavanaugh, specifically with respect to your question about whether it's possible to come up with a bright line test to be applied in these cases, I think the answer is yes, there is. In the Fields case, the House's position as an amicus in that case was that Browning was indeed too crude a proxy. The Browning test, as you'll recall, was if a disciplined employee had legislative duties, that was the end of the matter. The House agreed with that. What we proposed to the court at that time was that it do essentially what the Fields plurality did, except draw the line at the affidavit. That is, if an affidavit is placed in by the employing office explaining that the employee had legislative duties and that the employment action arose out of the performance or non-performance of those legislative duties, that would be the end of the matter.
Can I ask you about that? So just to be clear then, if the employee is the cafeteria manager,
yes,
and the employee says, my only job is to manage the cafeteria,
mm-hmm,
and the affidavit says that is a legislative duty,
mm-hmm,
that would end the case?
The only issue that would be litigable would be whether the duties described in the affidavit were legislative or not.
So that would be litigable as to whether
the issue as to whether the duties described in the affidavit were legislative or not. It would be a legal issue.
It would be a legal issue.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
So you would not go on to provide opportunity.
Facts as described in the affidavit were speech or debate protected, and that Fields plurality notes that that's still preserved, right?
Correct.
So there, with respect to whether there's a clear line, we still have the confusing question of whether they are legislative or not.
No, because the issue of whether something is legislative or not is a quintessentially judicial
it's
issue.
It's judicial, but it's still a line that, as you can, yes, but Fields itself indicates pretty clearly that it's not the clearest issue.
Well, it's about as clear and bright line a test as we were able to come up with.
All right, let me ask, well, that may answer the question. It's as clear as you could come up with, and maybe that's proves that we can't get one. But I want to be clear again. Let's say she says, I am a typist, and all I do is type. And you say, no, she's a legislative assistant who gives legislative advice to her boss. We have to accept your view that she's a legislative assistant if she puts in evidence that she's merely a typist? Is that the clear line?
Yes. The answer is, yes, it is. Now, what you're supposing, obviously, is that members may lie.
No, I'm not talking about a member here at all, frankly. I'm not sure that we haven't gone a little bit too far here, but we're not talking about a member. I'm talking about a staff member of a office that doesn't work directly for a member, just exactly this case, and she puts in evidence that I have a fifth grade education, all I can do is type, nothing else. You put in evidence, somebody says, actually she gives legislative advice, and that's what she did in this case. She says, no, I did not. I never did anything but type. We have to accept that's the bright line you want to draw, that the fact question has to be adjudicated by the House staff person himself?
You know, the answer is yes. And the reason for that is because
it's definitely a clear line.
It is definitely
it means
a clear
you win
line.
Every case, right?
No, I don't think so. I think what you would have is exactly
what
Judge Kavanaugh.
Well, Fields plurality said you win almost every case and left one fact pattern open. So it's hardly
a
big step.
I don't think that's fair, actually, if you look at the real world as opposed to hypotheticals. I mean, if you look at the real world, we're talking about members of Congress coming in and providing affidavits under oath. I mean, the members most of the time are going to be the employing offices in these cases. So you're talking about a member of Congress, a constitutional officer of the United States government.
Yeah, but that's not this case. That's what the Chief Judge is saying. This is not a member of Congress, so
that's
irrelevant. We have that in the back of our mind. And the stretch in this area is that it's beyond the members.
I'm sorry?
The stretch in this area is that it's beyond the members. We're talking about cases that go beyond members.
Okay, and I don't think it is a stretch in this case because the Chief Administrative Officer is, for Gravel purposes, an aide to two House committees. Chief Administrative Officer, if we've clearly acknowledged, has many indeed non-legislative responsibilities.
I understand, but that doesn't mean all of the subordinates of that person do.
No, but it does mean that the subordinates of the Chief Administrative Officer, when they're assisting him in carrying out his legislative responsibilities,
seems to me that's precisely the question. Suppose the affidavit is conclusory, as some of the statements in the affidavits here are, that they're not even asserting facts that we ought to accept that have been found, so to speak, by the person asserting them. They're conclusions that this person is doing legislative work.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the fact is very clear. I'm sorry, the affidavit is very clear factually on what duties were assigned to her, how those duties related to the chief administrative officer's responsibilities to the Committee on House Administration.
The question is whether that was the reason she was fired. I mean, she has a lot of duties, but as you yourself said, somebody can have legislative duties and somebody can still do things that are not legislative, correct?
All right. Correct.
So the entire long breadth of what her duties are isn't really the issue. The question is, was she fired because she did something that was a legislative act, right?
Well, that gets into Mr. Nabatov's argument that setting up is not legislative.
That's right. Yeah. Before we get to, you were gonna give a broad overview. One broad overview is whether you have a clear view. I understand your clear view is that whatever facts you state, we have to accept. That's your bright line.
That doesn't tell me anything, incidentally, in your broad view as to what you mean to say about Fields doesn't address the pretext cases. It leaves it open.
Well, I've got two issues here, and I've got pretext.
What you've done is just kind of warm up to get to the case that we're at. Fields leaves that as, well, we don't know. That's the pretext. That's a different situation.
Well, what I was trying to do is address Judge Kavanaugh's
concern. I'm not saying you did anything wrong. I'm just trying to tell you you haven't gotten to this case yet.
Okay, well, I'm on my way.
Can I waylay you? I'm sorry. I had one more general question, which is the one you heard me ask before and you wrote down.
Jurisdictional question.
Yeah. Is this a jurisdictional case or is it not? You agree that what the court described and what the plurality described in Fields as jurisdictional, that's been satisfied here, right?
No. I think what you're maybe confusing, Your Honor, is the immunity prong, of Fields versus the prong of Fields that's based on the nondisclosure protection provided by the clause.
Right, but
I believe both of those are jurisdictional.
Those aren't the words that the court used. The court used, that is, Judge Randolph described the first prong as a jurisdictional bar and the second prong as an evidentiary privilege, correct? Those are the words he used. It's not really, if this is a clear line question, I'm only asking you, aren't those the words he used?
Yes, I think when he said on the second prong, what he was talking about is the second protection, which I do believe is jurisdictional in nature, is predicated on a different protection provided by the speech or debate clause.
That's clear, literally right. The only question is it jurisdictional? I don't know the answer to that, so I'm asking you, why do you think it's jurisdictional rather than a privilege?
The reason I think it's jurisdictional is because when you marry the protection provided by the nondisclosure clause to the possibility of dismissal in advance, what you essentially done is created another version of immunity here. It's not the immunity from suit based on what you alleged in your complaint, which is what the first aspect of Fields was talking about. We acknowledge that that was not there. We acknowledge that a prima facie case had been stated, which is why this is not a 12b6 case. But when you marry the nondisclosure privilege and the protections provided to that with the likelihood that many of these complaints are going to have to be dismissed at this early stage, in effect, what you're talking about is another form of immunity, and I think that does sound in jurisdiction rather than in 12b6.
Have there been any cases, I look quickly, but I wasn't able to find any, that discuss the evidentiary privilege as jurisdictional? You know?
I'm not aware that this has come up in another context other than this one, Your Honor.
Okay.
Can I ask you, I realize this is an aside, but I'm interested in it, which is how does the Office of Compliance process work? Are the same remedies available?
Yes, essentially the same remedies. I mean, there's no jury, obviously, but
is it used, that process?
Yes,
What has happened in that process for plaintiffs who go through that process?
I don't know because my office typically doesn't represent members in that proceeding. There is a separate office of lawyers in the House called the Office of House Employment Counsels. House Employment Counsel, in most employment cases, that office represents the employing office. They have handled virtually all of the cases in that proceeding. We've handled one case there. The proceedings are very accelerated.
It's used and there are remedies available. That's why
I realize
it's an aside here, but I'm just curious because you mentioned in your brief that they can employ that process without implicating any speech or debate issues.
Right, which is why which was the upside of the bright line test I proposed, which is it lets them know in advance where they can go.
Can I ask you one more?
Yes.
Don't worry, we're going to give you time to get to the main event, but we each have some preliminaries. So my question is, the Act said that Congress was not waiving sovereign immunity for any senator or member of the House. And I guess my question here is, what gives the office that you're now representing, the individual who you're now representing, the authority to assert speech and debate? Is there a delegation that says, or maybe to the General Counsel of the House, is there a delegation from the House of Representatives saying that whenever you want to, you may raise speech and debate?
No, the answer is Gravel.
Well, Gravel's different. Gravel is a case where it was the personal aide of Gravel himself, and actually there's a place in there that said, of course, it can be disavowed at any point.
Correct.
We're not talking about any personal. I mean, does the House of Representatives have its own speech or debate authority, separate from that of any member?
Well, that's an open question, Your Honor. It's always been the position of our office that it does not. That the House does not.
So which individual member, by some delegation, by some alter ego, by some acting as the aide of, is the defendant in this case asserting the privilege?
It would be the members that sit on the Committee on House Administration and the Committee on Appropriations.
All of the members?
Yes.
Well, do we know whether all the members think this or not?
I think the affidavit made very clear that the Chief Administrative Officer communicated with those committees and that there was no objection to his assertion of the privilege in this case.
Ah, okay, I missed that part.
The last paragraph of his affidavit.
Okay, then that is a clear line. Good, thank you.
Shall I proceed to the main event?
Please.
Okay. In the court below, Ms. Howard's principal argument was that the Chief Administrative Officer of the House himself did not have any legislative responsibilities. That was her principal and overriding argument. That argument is obviously wrong. It was refuted in considerable detail.
Are we talking about the demotion issue or the?
No, we're talking principally about the termination claims.
Termination claim.
It was refuted in considerable detail by the Beard affidavit, and it was rejected by the lower court. That argument has disappeared on appeal. With respect to the termination claims, what has replaced it are two claims. One is that Ms. Howard can show pretext separate and apart from questioning her supervisors about what they told her to do and what instructions they gave her. And his argument, on which he puts considerable weight, that her so-called setup responsibilities were not, in fact, legislative. Let me deal with the pretext one first. Both the arguments are wrong. With respect to the pretext argument, Ms. Howard was very candid below that what she intended to do was question the supervisors about what was in the Beard affidavit and do exactly what Judge Kennedy said she could not do. So what she has now done on appeal is she's morphed to the position of claiming that there are admissions in the CAO's answer to the complaint and that there are inconsistencies between the CAO's answer and the Beard affidavit.
Can I ask you about, so sure. Would you assume for the moment that at least for me it's not enough that whatever you say about the facts are the facts. Just assume that for the moment. I haven't made up my mind about that, but now that I'm clear on what your position is, I just want you to assume that. So in the Beard affidavit, which is paragraph 14, which is, right, that's the part that goes to this question, right? That's the termination section, right? It's a JA-98.
Yeah, I have it.
And it's paragraph 14 is the one about why she was terminated, right?
Yes.
Okay, so it says, how do you pronounce his name? Qureshi?
Qureshi.
Qureshi repeatedly instructed Ms. Howard to complete the work on the contributions account which he had signed to her, and throughout this period, Ms. Howard repeatedly refused. Okay? She gets gets up and she says, I did not refuse to do anything that he told me to do. The problem was I had to use a computer to do it, and I didn't have a computer. I'm just going to make it a little cleaner for the purpose of this. They're saying they didn't have a particular drive of the computer, but just to be clear. Okay. Why does that implicate the speech or debate clause? It seems to me that the only necessary rebuttal is Mr. Qureshi gets up and says, She did repeatedly refuse, and she did have access to the O drive.
Well, I think Judge Kennedy's answer to that,
I don't care what Judge
with which I agree.
I understand. What's your answer to this?
The answer is that necessarily involves questioning her supervisors about what instructions were given to her and what access she had, and those are the things that Fields specifically says that she's not entitled to quarrel with.
I don't know what that means. Really, I mean, Chief Justice, I'm looking at the paragraphs. It's very straightforward. You either were given instructions and declined or not. Why do you have to wander into the legislative process? I'm missing it. You said that very generally. That's exactly what I was concerned about when I was questioning before, these very general conclusory assertions. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, it's not my conclusion, Your Honor. It's Judge Kennedy's conclusion.
You're here advocating on behalf of the House. So what is it? How did we on examination wander from this in paragraph 14 into a discussion of the legislative process? I'm missing it. Speech and debate. Where is that implicated?
Because
I told her to do something. She wouldn't do it. He didn't tell me to do something. I would do it. I didn't have the equipment. Now, where's speech and debate? I'm totally missing it. You may have a very fanciful notion of examination and cross-examination that goes way far afield. If I'm the trial judge, I won't let you
go. To make a pun, far afield, yeah.
Yeah, right. I won't let you go there if I'm trial judge, because this is a very focused examination. So now I'm curious to know, what are you talking about?
I'm relying on Fields.
Now, tell me what you're talking about specifically. I mean, you're drawing from Fields. Well, what are you talking about? You haven't asserted anything here that's speech and debate.
Well, in order to get to the question of whether she had access or not, you're necessarily going to get into questioning people. Because obviously our position is she did have, we've said that she did in fact have the access.
Okay, and is testimony that she had access, those words, mm-hmm. You think that is privileged, that she had access?
Yes, in the context of this case, I think it is.
Access to equipment is privileged?
But that's the best argument you have. I just want to be clear. Your argument is that if you had to testify she had access, that would be speech and debate protected.
If you're asking, is that the best argument I have on pretext? No.
No.
On that particular issue.
Forget about the words pretext. Forget about McDonnell Douglas. Forget about everything. Okay. The way the court case comes down is as follows: she gets on the stand, she testifies that they didn't give me any reason for firing me. Okay. They just didn't give me any reason at all. I had perfect performance records, etc. Your person gets on the stand. Your person testified. That's not correct. She was fired because she refused to do the job. Period. She gets back on the stand. She says, that's not true. I wasn't able to do the job because I didn't have a computer. You get on the stand and say, she had a computer. That's privileged.
You're talking at trial now, where you're talking about evidence and liability.
Yeah.
At that point, obviously, if the CAO gets put in that position, yeah, he is going to defend.
And then what is he going to
defend?
What does he need to say? We discussed, you quite properly mm-hmm. pointed out in the briefs about what Rustenkowski really meant, which is about voluntary stuff's not protected, but what's necessary is protected. Mm-hmm. What do you need to say other than she did have a computer? That's not true. She did have a computer. Why do you have to discuss anything else? And if so, what would the other thing be?
Okay. Again, you're talking about a procedural posture where she is at, where we're at trial.
Well, it can also be at summary judgment.
We're at a different procedural posture.
I understand. So, but it's a summary judgment at this stage. And the question is, what evidence, if she puts in an affidavit now, let's say we get to summary judgment. She puts in an affidavit that says, one, they didn't give me any reason. They gave me great performance records, reports. And two, Mr. Beard says in his affidavit that I refused. That's not correct. I didn't refuse. I had to use a computer, and they didn't give me one. Let's say that was her answer.
Sure.
What is it that you would be necessary as a defense that would require disclosing speech or debate clause material?
Well, in the and again, understand, at that stage, we're going to disclose, right? We're going to defend at that stage. So what I would have to say is that is wrong, and here is the reason that it is wrong.
To be clear again, her explanation is, I don't have a computer. They didn't put a box on my desk. Now, what would you have to say that would be legislative, that would have to be legislative? What would that be?
You know, I'm not sure in terms of putting a box on the desk.
Okay, now
she necessarily answer that question.
All right, fair enough. Now she says exactly what she says in this case. They gave me a box on my computer, but there was a certain drive that I had to have entry to in order to do what they asked me to do, and I did not have entry to it. What would you have to say other than she did have entry to it? Why is the substance of what is entered matter?
You would have to say, yes, she did, and here's how we know she did, because this person told this person to do it.
Yes.
Just as the complaint says, yes. Just as we admitted. I mean, the complaint says that. The complaint says that another person put the data on the drive that she had access to. Her own complaint says that. Of course.
I'm still not hearing what's legislative.
Not hearing the answer.
What's legislative? What testimony, what words would be legislative? Would be protected? What words?
The words that relate to the instructions on how to do the legislative task are themselves legislative.
By stating in conclusory terms how to do the legislative task.
I think it'll be easier if we just think about this in a series of hypotheticals.
Okay.
And her hypothetical, as they've represented now, maybe it'll turn out different when we get down there, in which case we'll be back up here. It's just the way these things go. They're going to say she didn't have access to a drive. What are you going to say in response?
And say that's wrong, and here's the reason why it's wrong.
Go ahead. What's the reason? What reason would you say that could evoke the speech and debate clause? Other than, why isn't the reason?
Because
she had access.
Because on this date, Mr. Qureshi said to Mr. Nudi, put the data on the drive. The drive is shared. Ms. Howard had access to the drive.
Yes.
I, Qureshi, told Ms. Nudi to do that.
Yes.
Ms. Nudi then says, I told Ms. Howard, the data is on the drive. You should go do the job. I mean, you're
that
now
all
talking
sounds
about
good. None of that sounds privileged to me.
There.
But I disagree. It is instructions in order to carry out a legislative activity.
Right,
and obviously,
fair enough. So we understand your point. Then you've made two points. One is whatever facts you say in describing the event, we would have to accept. And your second position is that any instructions to any employee are legislative, including how to use a computer?
Well, it didn't quite go that far.
Well, then tell me why that's different than what you said.
Because, let's talk, if we can talk about the context of this case, it makes it much easier for me. In the context of this case, her job was to assist the chief administrative officer in providing financial information needed by two committees in order to do their legislative responsibility. Okay? The delivery of that financial information is a crucial information provision step in the legislative process. That's spelled out in the affidavit. She was a cog in that process. She had.
To the same question we were before. You agreed that even cogs in the process, everything such a cog does is not legislative, right? You agree with that? You said that. Everything she does is not legislative, right? Am I right about that?
Everything she does, yes. Of course.
Okay.
Of course.
So now we have to decide which things are and which things aren't. In fact, what you just described to me as being legislative protective is really the same words you put in the affidavit. And I assume you didn't disclose anything that's legislatively protected under the speech and debate clause in paragraph 14. You said she was assigned to do this. She repeatedly refused. She had the necessary computer and data access to enable her to complete this task. You say that right here in the affidavit. Now, if that's privilege, you've waived it.
Well, Fields puts us in that position.
Okay.
For better or for worse,
Fields said at the beginning you weren't waiving anything.
Well, I understand. But we have not asserted it.
Fields required you to do.
But your position is that Fields, that aspect of Fields governs, right? Us, this panel.
Yes.
Okay, so for better or for worse, the sentence, Ms. Howard had the necessary computer and data access to enable her to complete this task. You're stuck with that sentence now.
Oh, yes. I'm not
okay,
I'm
so
not backing
what
away.
Else would they have to say to defend themselves from her claim that she didn't have access?
Okay.
What kind of thing?
That a legislator.
Okay, I believe I've answered the question, which is if you're talking about in either in the trial context or in the summary judgment context, the CA's office is going to go ahead and it's going to flesh that out. It's going to put details and it's going to put meat on that statement. And that gets into what was said to whom that relates to the instructions as to how to deliver this information, to get this information and data to those two committees. I'm not sure I can be much more
blunt than that. It sounds like what your answer is, if necessary, we'll just pad the case, even though the information we want to put in doesn't directly refute the claim that's being made. She either has the drive or she doesn't have the drive. Let me ask you this.
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. But
okay, I mean, that's what it sounds like.
Okay.
Suppose someone is a clerk or whatever the person is called, and someone in a office says, and the job of this person is deliver things back and forth to people who are sitting in the chambers. He's told, take these papers, which are all sealed and locked up, take them to someone on the floor. And he gets fired. The claim was he never took the papers. Is that legislative?
I would say no.
Yeah. Well, that's what I don't know whether that's where the chief, that's certainly what I'm getting from his questions, which are my questions. I didn't think it was legislative either. And I have a lot of trouble distinguishing, because certainly this person is holding legislative stuff, gets it from an office. It's clearly packaged in legislative, giving it to someone who was going to be debating in chambers about legislative materials, and yet you and I both agree the termination is not about a legislative matter. And he could fight it and say, I did deliver or I didn't deliver. And your answer would not go to, you couldn't say, well, wait, let me tell you what the office prepared and put in that envelope. It was really important stuff. And let me tell you what the person on the floor was going to say about that. It's all irrelevant, because the only question is, did he deliver it or not?
This entire line of questioning, Your Honor, just to be clear, it turns on the assumption that Ms. Howard was in fact given some ministerial-type task to set up the data in this computer.
Right, that's
and obviously, I don't concede that.
Well, you're right about that. If we have to accept your view, I think you're right. If we have to accept your view of the facts, then you win this case and you'll win every other case in which you assert facts. But if her position is, the reason I didn't do this is simply because I didn't have access to the computer. That's the only reason. And whether it's ministerial or not, they wouldn't let me touch the computer. So saying that I refused to do something isn't fair. And your answer is, actually, she did have access to the computer. Then it seems to me we have something that can be resolved without legislative privileges. And I'm not seeing where the legislative privilege is. Imagine that she really were merely a typist, nothing else. Okay, can I ask you to imagine that? She was just a typist. And she's fired, but the typing is, she's typing a report, like Ms. Browning. She's typing a report, which is going to be transmitted to the people in the, to the members of the House. And she's fired. She says it's because of my race. The House says it's because she, didn't finish the typing by 10 p.m. She says, they didn't give me a typewriter. Is that an impossible case to go forward?
Perhaps not in those simple and stark terms like that.
But why is that different than what we're saying here? Why don't you have to describe more of the content? Why in that case is it enough to say she's not telling the truth? We gave her a typewriter, and here, why is not enough to say she's not telling the truth, she actually had computer access?
The reason is because we are at a stage in the proceedings where the issue is, has she put forward enough evidence of pretext to permit the case to go forward in light of the Beard affidavit. That's the standard that Fields sets up. All the evidence of pretext upon which she is now relying is she's arguing that there are admissions in the CAO's answer and that there are inconsistencies with the affidavit. That's her evidence of pretext at this point.
Okay, so in a normal Title VII case, we would say she's put on evidence that she was told she was a great performer, and none of the reasons that were given now were given at the time. You respond, as you do in the affidavit, well, the real reason was that she refused to do the task. She puts in an affidavit that says, I didn't refuse the task, I didn't have computer access. That would get to the jury. That is a credibility fight between two pieces of testimony, right? I'm right about this so far, right?
You're in Title VII context.
Yes. So the only way this context changes is if either her testimony or your client's testimony is privileged.
No.
Is that right?
No. The reason it's different here, Your Honor, is because what you're describing actually is Judge Kennedy's ruling on count two, where he did identify.
Just tell me why it doesn't work here.
Because the evidence that she has of pretext, which are these supposed inconsistencies and the admissions, don't exist. Right? If you actually examine the complaint, there weren't any admissions that constitute pretext. There weren't any inconsistencies that constitute pretext. As a simple factual matter, all of this furor over things that we admitted and these inconsistencies do not exist with respect to counts one and four. Number two, none of this was brought up below. There was no argument below in the counts one and four context that she could show pretext by way of admissions, supposed admissions, and supposed inconsistencies. That appeared for the very first time on appeal. That argument's been waived. And the third issue is, as a matter of fact, Judge Kennedy accepted the Beard affidavit.
I don't understand that. So you have two affidavits. Nothing you've said so far is special about speech and debate. Everything you've said so far is a typical Title VII analysis, right? Right? You haven't said any words about speech and debate yet.
No, not yet.
Just said there's not enough pretext to go forward. I have the declaration of LaTanya Howard, which says, I didn't have the necessary computer access. I have the affidavit of Daniel Beard. We gave her computer access. That's a credit. Normally, that would be enough to get to the jury.
Yes.
So
in this context, what the Fields Court said was that she may not quarrel with legislative statements made in the affidavit.
I think that's an overstatement of what it said. It said that
I have the quote.
Yeah, I know it used the word quarrel, but the issue here is whether she has to quarrel about about something that has to do with the speech or debate clause, not about anything.
Not about anything. That's not what Fields means.
Okay.
That can't be what Fields means. That would make no sense whatsoever.
Okay, so fair enough. The last point, which I have been working my way to gradually here, is that the statements in the Beard affidavit were accepted as fact by the lower court.
But
that makes them subject to an erroneous
error. What basis? We have the same in a normal circumstance. Again, we're in Title VII territory. We don't accept these things as fact when there's no jury. We look at this and we review de novo whether a reasonable jury could find. We don't take a fact finding on summary judgment. There's nothing here that he didn't hear testimony. He had no basis for deciding credibility. We say where there's a credibility fight, you move on. You don't get summary judgment yet.
I think what the cases say that when there's a factual jurisdictional dispute, the finder of fact is entitled to look outside the four corners of the complaint. And in this case, he did exactly that.
But it has to pertain to matters covered by speech and debate.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Oh, no, that can't be right. Then my concerns are just going up dramatically. Fields could not possibly be read to say, use an affidavit to assert anything that's self-serving. And if there's some things in that affidavit that are about speech and debate, everything else has to be accepted. That makes no sense.
Well, I'm relying on cases like Herbert and Phoenix about the court looking outside the four corners of the complaint to resolve jurisdictional matters on affidavits and holding a clearly erroneous standard.
What I'm trying to say is I look at the affidavit and I see there's some things that you would argue, probably correctly, this pertains to speech and debate. But then I look at, and the termination was the one that I did. It's interesting, Judge Garland, the same thing. Paragraph 14, it's not about speech and debate. It's a very simple, narrow, straightforward Title VII. You said X, I said Y. We'd never grant summary judgment on this kind of record if it came up to us. And nothing about paragraph 14, which responds to what she's asserting, has anything to do with speech and debate, as far as I can see. And the fact that there's other stuff in the affidavit that does is beside the point. Has nothing to do with speech and debate. And if you really mean that Fields means to say you can pack your affidavit with all kinds of goodies and we have to, the Court of Appeals, District Court, must accept them because some of what you say goes to speech and debate, albeit irrelevant to the case at hand, that has to be wrong.
I didn't say you had to accept it. All I said is Judge Kennedy did accept it.
This is precisely my point. In our normal jurisprudence, he has no authority to accept it because I put that in the Title VII category. They're disputed facts, which go to a jury. No jury, we can't assume anything. They're two disputed facts. She says X, you say Y. We wouldn't accept that on appeal. If we got this coming up on summary judgment, we'd reverse and send it back and say it has to go to trial. They're material facts in dispute.
Let me, the phrase in Field is, we merely note that a plaintiff who seeks to prevail by quarreling with the defendant's statements about activity protected by the speech or debate clause,
mm-hmm.
not with quarreling about whether their statements, this activity is speech and debate clause, just about statements that are protected. It's a prior question that we have to resolve here. There's nothing in Fields that says what you're saying. In fact, as you mentioned, you proposed that in Fields, and it wasn't accepted. It wasn't rejected, but it certainly wasn't accepted. Isn't that fair?
Yes.
Okay, let me ask one. I know we're...
I got a few, too,
okay,
but
yeah.
Go ahead.
I want to talk about the demotions issue, so if you want to talk...
No, go ahead.
Okay, on the demotion, can we talk about that for a minute? On the demotions issue, I know you don't just describe it that way, but just for purposes of me understanding where we are, if I could just do that. So now we're talking about paragraph 13 of the Beard affidavit, correct? Beard affidavit, paragraph 13. I altered Mrs. Howard's job duties for three reasons, right? The first one, she lacked interpersonal skills. Now, assume that was the only reason, just for the moment. Is that speech and debate protected?
No.
Okay. The second obviously isn't because all you're saying is she had analytical skills. So it's really the third that's the...
Yes.
Okay. So the third says, most importantly, Ms. Howard made it difficult for me to effectively support the legislative activities by not sharing information with other employees and by not listening to other employees and by communicating, this is, and it's the third that matters, right? You're shaking your head, I just want to be sure.
Yes, I'm agreeing.
And that is, by communicating to the Committee on Appropriations and others information that reflected her own budgetary preferences and views rather than the views of the CAO. That's the crux of what would be protected, right?
Yes.
Okay, now you heard the other side say they agree that they cannot dispute that point. So if that's the case, why isn't this again a case where she says, I got great performance reviews, they never said there was anything wrong with my interpersonal skill. I don't know whether this is true or not, of course. Never said anything was wrong with my interpersonal performance skills. They told me that the reason was they were just changing the job. It has nothing to do with me. You respond by saying, no, that's not the reason. She communicated her own views, not the office's views. She can't respond to that. She can't say, all she can say is, nah, that's not the reason they did it. But they can't She can't dispute in any way that she communicated her own views. Now, why is there something still left that is necessary for you to use in defense that's protected by the clause?
Again, we are at the motion to, we're at the summary judgment motion or stage or?
Yes, we're at, we're at whatever stage we're at now, whether it's B1 or 12B6, but we're at this stage now. Why does this suggest that to go to any further stage of the proceedings would require disclosure, testimony, et cetera, however you want to describe the privilege of speech and debate material?
Well, I think Judge Kennedy concluded based on...
And I appreciate the problem here is, at least from my view, we're viewing this de novo, okay? I got your clear error issue, but just for right now, assume we're reviewing de novo this question. What is it that you need to put on that's protected by the speech or debate clause once they have stipulated that she transmitted information that were her views rather than the office's views?
I mean, if she stipulates to that fact, I don't think I have to put anything additional on.
Okay, well, then we go back down. That may be the end of it. It then becomes a question for the jury. Was the reason that you put on, or was the reason that she put on? And it may even be that no reasonable jury could conclude their way, and that the district court should resolve it on that ground. But that is not the ground the district court resolved it on. The district court resolved the case on the ground that this really is a speech or debate clause case. It's looking to me more and more like it's a straight Title VII kind of case. But I'm asking you, where is the speech and debate element here, given that, assume we would say that district court is able to say, you may not deviate in light of your representations and in light of the fact that it's covered by the speech and debate clause, you may not put on evidence that what you put in was actually the committee's views rather than your views. Doesn't that completely protect you on this issue with respect to the speech or debate clause?
No, I don't think it does, Your Honor, because what we're looking at here is whether we're entitled to have this complaint dismissed or not. That's the issue before the court, not how we're going to proceed down the road, but whether we're entitled to have the complaint dismissed today.
Only if you're entitled to have it dismissed on speech or debate clause grounds. That's the only issue we accepted here.
Well, that's where the field's plurality comes in, which is she has to put forward evidence of pretext. The district court said that she did. We have challenged, among other things, the amount of evidence. The field's completely left open the question of how much pretextual evidence the plaintiff would have to come forward in order to permit the case to go forward. That is the case, that is the issue we've teed up for you with respect to the count two of the so-called demotion claim, which is how much evidence of pretext is sufficient to permit this case to proceed on down the road. And we're saying the amount of pretext evidence here is diminishingly small, and you should at least set a bar, given the nature of the speech or debate clause, that's sufficiently high to protect members of Congress.
So I read that part of Fields as being, that's the concern where the defendant would be required to look at speech and debate clause material in order to defend himself. Not just any old case against Congress, a case where their speech and debate clause is involved. I mean, if that were the case, then that would be a special rule for Congress, say in Bivens actions, that's totally unrelated to the speech and debate clause. And I don't think Fields was trying to say that.
I don't think I'm following your
right, so, I mean, your Honor, fair enough. So, I don't know. Davis versus Passman. Supreme Court said there's a Bivens cause of action for firing somebody because they're a woman. Correct? That's what the Supreme Court said. Okay. So, imagine that, let's leave out any possible speech or debate clause issues. Imagine she was a server in the cafeteria. 25 people heard, and she says that her manager fired her because you're a woman, I don't want you, and the manager says, I fired you because of bad performance. Now, it may be that there's not enough to get to the jury in that case, but you wouldn't argue a special protection for Congress in that case, right? There's no speech or debate clause issue.
I wouldn't.
Okay. So in this case, if there is no speech or debate clause issue, Why do we look at it any different than we look at any other Title VII? And I'm asking, what is the speech or debate clause issue in the demotion question? If they concede that they can't put on any evidence and they can't make you put on any evidence and you don't need to put on any evidence about whether she communicated her views or the committee's views.
Again, you're talking about leaving aside the field's plurality and the whole that's it, and just letting the case go forward. What problems would we face? What issues would we have to deal
with? I'm asking you to, again, I guess maybe my view about the field's plurality is it's only where there's a speech or debate clause issue. And my question is, where is the speech or debate clause issue?
Well, if she is going to stipulate to the matters
affidavit.
In the affidavit, then I think we go straight to summary judgment.
Right. And so it's not, again, to be clear, when she's not saying she's going to stipulate that that's the reason she was fired, but she's going to stipulate that.
Well, this is the demotion. This is the demotion count, right?
Right.
Yes. Yes. She's going to stipulate, I mean, that she was demoted, but she is going to stipulate that, and I think probably because she thinks she has to, because she can't avoid the speech and debate clause question unless she does. She's going to stipulate that she did communicate evidence, information that reflected her own budgetary preferences and views rather than the views of the CAO. She's going to stipulate to that. So why doesn't that take out any speech or debate clause issue?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think it does if you're assuming that the case is going to go forward into discovery and summary judgment and so on and so forth. I think it probably does. I don't think that's what the field's, I disagree with you that that's what the field's plurality requires.
Judge Kemp, I have a
question. You've been arguing in the alternative a lot, but on reading the field's plurality, your view, just so I understand it, is if the affidavit comes in and it does describe speech or debate activity, then that's it, right? The things that were left open in the field's case, are those still open, or would you close those, or close one of them? I guess you would close the pretext door.
Well, no, to be clear, what you're talking about, my view of the field's plurality?
Mm-hmm.
My view of the field's plurality?
Well, no, your view, field's plurality leaves this open.
The pretext.
Right? It says,
yes.
It articulates a principle and then purports to leave open two fact patterns that, in my view, are probably covered by the principle it articulated. But what's your view on that, on the pretext one? In other words, can you get behind the affidavit by alleging pretext? I took your brief, at least part of it, to say, no, you can't, but even if you can, it's got to be a high bar.
Well, yes, I did say that, and that was based upon the language in the fields. It says the plaintiff who seeks to quarrel.
Right.
That language. Right. That is what that is based upon.
Okay.
So my view is that if she's going to demonstrate pretext, it's got to be elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Outside of quarreling with those legislative matters.
Right. Okay. And then going back to a factual question on this Office of Compliance, how many of these kinds of cases now are pending in court? Do you have any idea? Discrimination cases. I mean, rough. There are a lot.
I don't know about discrimination, but Congressional Accountability Act cases, I would, and again, my office doesn't typically litigate those, but my guess would be in the neighborhood of, in federal court, somewhere between 3 and 5
okay.
around the country.
You know how many are in the Office of Compliance?
I do not have information on that. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. We'll give you a few more minutes. We gave a lot of time to the other side. Why don't you give 2 minutes?
Just briefly, we have established a pretext without implicating the speech and debate clause. And even if you set it at a high bar, we have. With respect to the demotion count, we have alleged that she was specifically told that she was being removed from budget director to senior advisor because they were abolishing the budget directorate. Now in the affidavit, lo and behold, we have new reasons. At this stage of this proceeding, without any discovery, that in and of itself constitutes pretext, and certainly in a Title VII case.
But they're going to come in and try to show that the reasons they're stating now were the true reasons, and that's going to inevitably going to implicate speech or debate issues, which, as Chief Judge Garland said, means it's going to be right back up here.
It's not going to implicate speech and debate.
You don't think so? No. You think you're going to go back to district court and not implicate speech or debate? I doubt it.
Even if it were implicated, the issue with the demotion with respect to conversations with budget committees, we believe are speech debate. We don't have to deal with that. The question...
Wait. You said that pretty fast. Could you say that a little bit slower?
You only gave me 2 minutes.
We believe...
No. We wouldn't have to deal with that.
So, right. Just like you said.
Just to be clear, you agree that if they say, in fact, you will stipulate to what they said in paragraph 13, that she, your client, communicated to the Committee on Appropriations and others information that reflected her own budgetary preferences and views rather than the views of the CAO, correct?
We will stipulate that's what they assert, yes.
Are you going to stipulate
that? No, that she did that.
Okay, yes, fine.
Judge Garland's been saying that
that's
you'll stipulate.
That's not a problem.
Yeah, I want to be clear.
I'm right, I'm confused.
Are you going to stipulate to that or not?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that's because you agree that information that was actually transmitted is protected by the speech and debate.
Absolutely, and that's why we...
If you were to get to discovery and you were trying to get some other vaguely related issue, it goes down to actual transmissions of information to the committee, you would not be able to get that. You agree, you would not be able to get
that,
right?
Absolutely.
Your only fight could be over what the court should make of the fact that they changed their reasons and whether or not she indeed lacked interpersonal skills.
And her prior employment history in her appraisals. That is correct. That is correct. And that is enough to go to a jury based on...
Well, I'm not voicing any opinion on it. I'm just confirming my understanding of what you assume you would do. That's it.
That is correct.
The only case you can make.
And with respect to the termination, finally, there is no speech and debate implicated. It is as simple as she didn't get a computer. There is no legislative implication at all. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you. I just want to say we've been aggressive on both sides. It's a very hard issue for us, as it obviously was for the Fields panel, and we greatly appreciate it. We think this was advanced by the discussion. We'll take the case under submission.